Ann Anderson is an affiliate of the Institute for Education and Social Policy at New York University and a consultant for the Center for Law and Education in Washington, D.C. She also served as a consultant for several years with the National Committee for Citizens in Education. She has a very interesting resume. She's developed a training session on working with families to improve student achievement for the National Association of Elementary School Principals. She developed a curriculum to enhance parent involvement in middle school in Louisville, Kentucky. She was just involved in an evaluation of a parent education program, which was delivered to 100,000 parents in California. She's written a number of articles, reports, and books. Let me give you the names of a couple of these. Learning from Others, Good Programs and Successful Campaigns. Two of them I actually have on my shelf because I find them so useful. This one is A New Generation of Evidence, The Family is Critical to Student Achievement. This is very user-friendly. This is one-page summaries of 65 key articles on parent involvement. It's very useful. The other one is Beyond the Bake Sale, she calls it, An Educator's Guide to Working with Parents. It's a very good summary of what influences parental involvement in schooling. She's written one book that I haven't read, which I thought sounded rather intriguing. And at first, I wondered if it was Anne's book on parenting theory, since I know that she and her husband have one daughter. The book is called No Strings Attached and Anything Goes. But when I looked a little closer, I realized it was actually a report on educational block grants. So I want to commend you. It's the first time I thought a book on educational block grants actually looked kind of interesting. So she's just completed another book called Urgent Message. This one is summarized in your briefing report. Professor Ryshofsky's presentation is also in your briefing report. And this was a report of the recommendations of 45 organizations who were involved in school reform. So she'll be talking today about families and communities crucial to school reform. Welcome, Ann, all the way from Washington.
All across the country, we're talking about the desperate need we have to reform education so that we have schools in this country that educate all children to high standards. This is the goal of the Goals 2000 Act, the National Education Goals. Many states have jumped on that bandwagon. And it's a very important, critical thing to do, if only for selfish reasons, which is that demographers estimate that in about 10 years there are only going to be 3 people working for every retiree. And looking around the room, a lot of those retirees are going to be us in 10 years. And if a third or more of those who are working have not succeeded, have dropped out, or on the streets and not producing, we're not going to be able to retire. Of course, there are many, many other reasons why this is so important, moral, social, and so on. And I don't think I need to sell the need for this to you. But what the urgent message is that we've written about is that world-class schools that educate all our students to high standards are not going to happen unless parents and communities are involved in bringing this about. First of all, because unless parents and community people understand the standards and the changes that have to take place in schools and the shifts in funding that have to take place so that this will happen, there's not going to be the political will to weather the controversy to bring this about. And another reason is that when reforms are crafted with parents and community people at the table, they're much more likely to be effective, to be respectful of community, and to work in the schools. I know I was in Kansas City recently, and under the major desegregation order that's been pending there for the last 10 years, the state has pumped in $1.8 billion extra to that school district. They've built new facilities, they've hired teachers, they've done all sorts of things, and the test scores have not budged. And the people who live in that district, whose children go to school in that district, who work in that district, have felt that what has happened in that district has been out of their control. It's been court orders, it's been state plans, it's been this, it's been that, and there's been little or no ownership, and the funds were basically spent to put people on the payroll who didn't have a coherent plan for using that money in ways that would really bring about improvements in student achievement. And the third reason it won't happen is that, as my esteemed colleagues who came before me have mentioned, when kids do better in school when their parents are involved. And the schools they go to get better if they're open to parents and engage them. And this is not necessarily a middle-class paradigm misplaced, because I think that what we need to look at are ways of engaging families that go way beyond the standard middle-class model for parent involvement. Now, why is it that involving parents, particularly low-income parents, in education produces really significant gains in student achievement and in school effectiveness? We can look at the first transparency here for a minute and just look at the impacts of this. I've been tracking this research since 1981. Because when I went out of the country on a month-long vacation, I came back and discovered that in my absence, Congress had repealed nearly all the parent involvement requirements in federal law, which basically said to me that Mark Twain was right. Nobody's liberty or property is safe as long as you guys are in session. So I went and looked up all the research I could find on the relationship between parent involvement and student achievement, and found 35 studies then that documented positive effects. In fact, it was fascinating that a whole body of social science research would all point in the same direction. And I've been updating that ever since. And this is sort of the bottom line on that research survey, and we can, if you wish, later discuss all the ins and outs of this research, but the benefits are very clear. Students like school better, they earn higher grades and test scores, they stay in school longer, and they get more education. But it doesn't stop there, because when they're engaged in education, parents gain self-confidence, and low-income parents who are not well-educated tend to go back to school themselves, and they tend to learn more at school, and they feel supported by the school and able to help their children better at home. For teachers who get to know families expect more of the students whose parents they've met. If you were a teacher in a classroom, you had 27 kids in your class, and half of those families came to school at the beginning of the year and said, I want to work with you. I want my child to do well. I'll help. I'll reinforce at home what you tell me to do. I'll come to school and work with you. I want my child to do well. I want my kid to go on to college even if I never went. You're going to expect more of that child or those children whose parents you've heard from and you know support them at home. And if you don't ever see or hear from half your students' parents, you might expect the worst of them. You might think they don't care about their kids, they don't support education, because in your middle-class view, parents who don't come to school, who don't express that, must not care, whereas the reality could be very different. Bridging that gap between home and school, then, reinforces strengths of families, it reinforces the value of education, and it helps children integrate the differences, whatever they may be, in culture and background and so on, between home and school. And schools that do this, and there are lots of studies about this, that look at schools that are similar in terms of the demographics of the areas that they serve, who are very different, or the schools are very different in terms of their relationship to their community. But schools that are open to their communities, that are known to work with families, whose facilities are available for meetings, that may be polling places on election day, those schools earn more support from the community. They have better reputations. And the research shows that they deserve them, that schools that are more open to the community, generally speaking, have higher average student achievement, higher graduation rates, tend to have more kids who go on to higher levels of education. So this is a pretty compelling body of evidence, I've found. In fact, I think it's pretty indisputable that when you have a healthy relationship between a school and its families, the school is more effective and kids do better. And furthermore, the gain is more noticeable and pronounced in low-income areas. In other words, kids from middle-class families tend to do pretty well in school, whether their parents are involved or not, because they have a certain sense of who they are, a background that values education. Their parents have been well-educated. They expect that of themselves, and they tend to do well in school. Obviously, there are individual variations, but just looking at the aggregate. Whereas low-income kids whose parents don't understand the system, didn't do well in school themselves, have little confidence about their ability to help their kids, and are very intimidated and frightened by going to schools, who often do blame them for their children's low achievement. You see a spiraling down. Those kids tend not to do well in school. A lot of this boils down to attitudes. People who do well in school feel that they have some control over their life, that if they work hard, somebody's going to notice it and reward or recognize them, and that if they work hard, they can make a contribution, that they are valuable and can contribute something to the world. In Jesse Jackson's words, there are people who feel that they are somebody. And when schools don't work with families, when schools write them off or treat kids as though they were hatched in eggs outside the schoolhouse playground, are reinforcing attitudes that get in the way of achievement. They're saying to the families, we don't think you have anything to offer. You don't even know how to read. So therefore, we're not going to work with you. They're treating the families like nobody, and the kids read this very perceptively and feel like they're nobody too, and they don't do well in school, and they have trouble integrating the differences between home and school, and they tend to perform poorly and drop out. As James Comer says, children learn from people they bond to, people who care about them, people who know and respect their families. This is pretty powerful stuff, and I think that a lot of schools don't understand this. Schools tend to be very closed places that are important providers of middle-class jobs in the community and are systems that function within themselves and regard themselves as run by professionals who are trained and who therefore don't really need a lot of help from families. And I think that this kind of deficit closed model of schooling is behind a lot of the tremendous disparities that we see between schools in high-poverty urban areas and in non-urban areas. I was just looking at the Quality Counts report that was published by Education Week, and I turned to the section on Wisconsin in preparation for coming, and I noticed that in high-poverty urban schools in Wisconsin, the math and science scores of eighth graders are about 28% of eighth graders are at basic level or better. In other words, only 34% of the kids passed the tests. Whereas in non-urban schools, whether high or low income, 81% of eighth graders passed the tests. This is a huge disparity. And I think that a lot of it can be attributed to the fact that people who go to school in high poverty urban areas are very isolated and their families don't know how to advocate for higher quality schools. They don't even know that high quality schools are something they could have. They think that the reason that the kids are performing so poorly is that they didn't do well in school themselves. They don't even think that it might be a low quality of education in the schools. And yet when you look at the statistics on schools in urban areas, including your own state's urban areas, you see big disparities in the education level of teachers and resources available for kids, and so on. In fact, many of these schools are entirely low-track schools, but the families don't understand all of these issues and don't know how to advocate for higher quality education, and there isn't the pressure on the system to respond. I've just been told I have 5 minutes left, and what I'd like to do with my 5 minutes is talk about some places I've visited where low-income families have been very much involved in school reform and where the achievement in the school has soared as a result. For Urgent Message, we wanted to find schools not only that had made significant improvements, but where deep reforms had taken place and where, as a result, way more than a majority of kids were scoring more in that 81% level that you expect in non-urban upper-income schools. And we had to look pretty hard, but we found some, and it was interesting because they had a lot of commonalities. Let me tell you about one of them. One of them was in Kentucky, and the reason I picked that is that it's a state that does have a strong state school reform law, so there are a lot of provisions in state law and that districts have adopted in order to respond to the standards-based environment the state has created, so that you can see how the pieces fit together. Engelhard Elementary School is in inner city Louisville. It accepts all the children from the city's 5 homeless shelters. It's about 79 or 80% low income. And until 4 years ago, it had the highest mobility rate in the state, 49%. Now, if you're trying to improve achievement in a school with a mobility rate of 49%, you don't have to be Andy Ruschowski to figure out the numbers there, that you're testing a completely different group of kids every year, and what you're doing with the kids just isn't getting measured. So one thing this school said is, we've got to reduce our mobility rate. And they said, well, how do we do that? That's usually something schools feel that they have no control over. Also, they looked at their school council, which has parents on it, looked hard at their school data. Where did they get that data? They got it from the state education agency because the tests came in and then it was disaggregated and presented in ways that parents and lay people could understand to help them look at how kids in that school were doing. And what they found was that the lowest achieving group in the school was fourth and fifth grade African American boys. This is not a news flash to anybody working with low-income schools. And so they basically said, the only way we're going to figure this out is to talk to our families. And they made home visits, they convened meetings in the community, they asked community groups to help, parents came into the school. And the school said, we, this school community, have a problem. And that is very low achievement among our kids, especially among the boys. What can you tell us? And the parents said, we don't think our boys are learning how to read. And they looked closer at the data, and yes, that was in fact the case. African American girls, interestingly, were learning to read almost as well as middle-class white and African-American kids. And so the problem was really with the boys. And the parents said, our kids need more time in school. 180 days a year from 9 to 3 isn't enough. We need after-school programs. We need a longer school year. The kids need to be tutored. We need you to do whatever it takes to make sure that our kids learn reading and math and basic skills. And that school completely reorganized itself. And now its Title I program is totally focused on literacy from K to 3. No kid gets out of third grade until he or she learns how to read. They don't have remedial reading teachers in fourth and fifth grade anymore. They don't need them, but they've reduced class size. In addition, the school went to its families and said, what would it take to keep you here? What do we need to do so that you can keep your children in this school? And the family said, well, you could start by treating us like human beings when we come in the door. And the school said, oh. I'm supposed to stop now. But in any case, I'll tell you that the achievement level at that school has more than doubled in 4 years, and their mobility rate is down to 17%. And we can talk in the question and answer and discussion about more about how they did that and other schools have.
Questions for Ann Henderson? Yes. The question was, what could we learn from others around the country and other parts of the world where kids are doing better? Are there things we could learn from them? And how could the educational system be a little bit more responsive in training teachers?
Well, a short answer is that I would love to go to Germany and Japan and look at what they're doing over there if somebody would like to give me a grant to do that. I think that is a good idea. And I'm certainly not saying that the only thing we need to do is involve families. What I'm saying is that involving families and deciding about the changes that have to take place is what we need to do. Parent involvement alone won't change anything. The quality of teaching in the school and the responsiveness of the school to the community is what's important. One thing to remember is that Germany, Japan, and many other countries to which we're often invidiously compared are very different from our country. They're much less heterogeneous. We have more diversity in this country than in any other country in the world, and what we're trying to do in our schools is very difficult, melding all of these different cultures and backgrounds. We also invest less in education in this country than many other countries do, and I think that we need to understand that we must make an investment in our children, and it's going to take more money than we're now spending to do what it takes. And one thing we need is universal developmental preschool for children from families that are at risk, from low-income families, and that needs to involve a lot of parent education so that when kids arrive at school, the playing field is a lot more level.
What incentives can the state provide to encourage more community involvement in the school?
That's a very apropos question. In Kentucky and in a couple of other states, there is funding by formula for family resource centers in all schools with 20% or more low-income families. This is an extremely valuable and not really that expensive strategy because it's seed money that basically allows social services to come to and be delivered at the school to give families in crisis the supports that they need. Another thing, of course, is to create a rigorous standards-based environment and to send out data on schools to parents and parent organizations so that they can see what the picture is in their school and work with their school to identify the weaknesses and address them. Both Kentucky and Texas send out school report cards. So the kids come home with their own report card, but parents get a school report card. It's one thing to know your kid is 2 years behind in reading and math, and another thing to know that every other kid in the class is, too.